In other news.
To determine why and how the towers collapsed.
Kind of scary to have this helicopter hovering around.
We walk up to him and confront him. They can't stand that.
Welcome to Another News. I'm Jeff Brady. In our ongoing series exploring various cases of organized stalking, we chronicle the events in the life of a targeted person who would like to remain anonymous and will use the name Michaela. Keep in mind the New York Times and Vice have reported on gang stalking and feature articles and documentaries, but have carefully framed victims as mentally ill. That discredits those experiencing organized stalking as paranoid. In Michaela's case, there are several parallels to past interviews, such as the target being an empath who is in a relationship with a psychopath. Michaela's parents also have occult and military connections. Michaela became aware of the stalking about 10 years ago after ending her second marriage. Since then, she's become a trauma counselor and has learned more about the repression of memory and government mind control programs. Michaela joins us today to share more information about her experiences. Michaela, welcome to Another News.
Thank you so much for having me, Jeff.
Michaela, would you please give listeners some background about yourself?
Well, I live in Canada. I grew up here as well. I come from a military family of five children. I was the middle child. Being in the military, of course, we moved around a fair bit across Canada. My father was predominantly of English descent, and my mother was of Irish descent, with a very long history of Freemasons and Royal Archmasons and further back some Druids, so very colorful history she had. I grew up with what has been described to me as some inherited sensitivities on my mother's side. She tended to be quite psychically sensitive, and it appears I was the only one of the siblings that inherited that. So I've been called lots of things, empath, telepath. I've been called a seer and occasionally a prophet, and I don't call myself anything. I just simply accept that some people are a little more sensitive than others, but it's not really something I focus on. I have five great kids of my own and all grown now and in their prospective careers. I worked with families in grief in the corporate field for years and years, and that evolved into studying psychological trauma. And so I currently work as a trauma practitioner, both in private practice and also with groups as well.
Well, you began to notice gang stalking events around the end of your second marriage. Would you tell listeners, please, about that time?
Yeah, roughly about a year and a half before the marriage ended, I left the corporate field and decided to try my hand at a business of my own. And so now I am home all the time, and I'm working from an office in my home. And I started to pick up on all kinds of things. It was almost like there had been too many unexplainable things in the marriage for too long, and my whole subconscious was kind of starting to override my conscious. And so I was sensing things I couldn't explain, and I knew something more than what I had thought was going on but I just didn't know what. So I started to really pay attention to things and investigate things more thoroughly, and as I did, my ex-husband started to become more and more paranoid, and his behavior started to become quite erratic, and it appeared I was making him a little nervous. So while I was working out of the home, when I was working at work, he always managed to have one day off during the week while I was working. So I wasn't there to see, you know, what he was doing on his day off. But now I was. I would go camping with my daughters for the weekend, and if he joined us, say, on a Saturday evening, I'd find him gone again by the time we got up the next morning. On his days off, he was going to town but couldn't really account for the amount of time, you know, he was gone. And then suddenly, as I'm sort of investigating what's going on, my youngest son died, under very tragic circumstances. So now I'm left suffering from complex trauma and complicated grief, and I was completely destroyed. So It's my guess that my ex-husband thought I was too distraught to notice what he was doing, and he started to get quite careless. And so I'd had about enough of trying to figure out what on earth was going on, and my senses had become overwhelming. So I purchased a tracker and a small recorder, and I slipped them into his vehicle. And I also had a private investigator who was recently retired police officer. I called him, and he did a lot of surveillance on him, and he described him as someone who behaved like he'd been arrested 10 times. The tracker showed him on endless back roads, odd places where he was supposed to be at work. He lied about where he had been and what he was doing. But on three occasions, the recorder picked up a female voice. Now, I learned much later that when you're involved in things you shouldn't be, there's some kind of don't talk rule going on, but somebody messed up, obviously, and they did talk. And so it showed the vehicle pulling over, doors opening and closing, seats moving, and a female voice that coincided with the tracker. So once it was in a vacant field at 6 in the morning, on another occasion, I had taken something to get some sleep, and it showed him leaving the drive before 9 p.m. and not coming home all night at all. It showed where he'd been, everything. It was really quite an amazing tool. So there were businesses he stopped at and a lot of property and houses for sale as well. At that point, I had him removed from the family home. I still knew there was more, but couldn't quite get a grasp on it. About a month or so later, a friend offered for me to come and work for him. He said, just as much as little time you want to put in. I had closed my own business completely in 2011, so I went to see a client of his and needed him to email me some lithos. He did, and when I pressed print, 640 porn pictures downloaded on my computer. I was on my way out to an appointment, and when I returned, I noticed that some of the pictures I'd seen had been deleted. I am not, any kind of a computer giant, so I couldn't figure out what had happened to these pictures. So at that point, I simply Googled amateur porn submitted from and the area I lived in, and an entire porn site came up, and with some of the duplicate porn pictures that it downloaded on my computer were on there as well. And so the dates that some of it was submitted coincided with dates that I had been away with my children or when he was supposed to be at work. So I took the computer into a computer shop, and they told me that my hard drive had been partitioned, and there was a virus in the start menu and the rootkit. And they said it was common for organized crime to do that because they felt better you get caught with your porn than them. They said they could do anything once those viruses were on there. They could turn my computer on when I had turned it off. They could see everything I was doing. They could delete things, change dates on anything, read my emails, whatever they wanted to do. So until that point, I was unaware he'd even been using my computer. There was also a separate login menu and a separate email account, and I was able to pull up some of the those emails up. From there, a friend started to help me pull whatever else was on the hard drive, including software for changing backgrounds on pictures and software for sending material to various porn sites and ability to trace IP addresses. There was also spreadsheets with addresses and phone numbers, offshore banking. So photos of what looked like shipments of drugs, among other things, and that's when the stalking started.
Thanks for going into detail there. Well, Michaela, past guest Debbie Johnson, a target of organized stalking, had talked about a small town in Missouri she visited last year where she and her husband were followed, and they noticed a general abasement regarding the quality of people. This year, she visited the same town, and things were noticeably better. However, she then discovered a major drug network was taken down recently that operated in that town. Would you give listeners a general description of the area that you live in and some of the known criminal and occult elements?
Sure. I think that organized crime is pretty prevalent in the whole country and all of Canada. There has been several books written about it, but I live in an area that has always been notorious for its occult presence, and organized crime element is far from a secret here. There are pockets in Canada that seem worse than others. In the province of British Columbia, for example, a recent news article has exposed an extremely high level of money laundering in casinos and real estate. driving the cost of housing so high the young can't afford it. According to the expose, the laundering is tied to the drug trade and organized crime. And under the Liberal Democrats, the laws governing money laundering were very weak at the time. So Canada and BC are a target because they were easy. They're easy. And also because there's the ports in Vancouver. And there are still a property to be had, so grow-ups are very common. I mean, I don't think there's anyone who hasn't heard of BC Bud. And the weather's accommodating. So then I am told the pot then is then traded in California or some other place for cocaine. The occult isn't a secret either. Witches and warlocks are very open about it. Occult shops are endless and numerous. In Manitoba and British Columbia, some of the very earliest architecture bear Freemason symbols and ancient Egyptian goddess symbols are everywhere. Pagan pride parades are held in the open and celebrated. I just recently had a friend tell me he got a call from someone who was involved with a satanic cult and couldn't get out because everywhere they went for help, they would discover they were somehow connected. So not a secret, either one of them.
Michaela, would you please give some background on your husband so listeners can get an idea of his character and also the dynamic between you two?
If you were looking in from the outside, you would have sworn that my ex-husband was just a regular guy who would have probably been described as a diamond in the rough. He was also a military kid, and he worked in the automotive industry. He went to work on time. He came home on time. There were no overt signs that anyone could kind of put a finger on. He never raised a hand to me during our marriage. He never called me names. He never told me what to do or not to do. However, I experienced pretty continuous gaslighting, pathological lying, sabotage, backbiting. And then there would be periods of quiet and normalcy, but there was never a we in the relationship. I was as much alone as if I had been, you know, just a single parent. And more responsibility was left with me, raising the children, being the breadwinner, taking care of the home. And there simply wasn't anybody else there. So he would solicit anger and then kind of victimize himself with it. So he also had a drive to be the center of attention no matter where we went. He literally performed as if no one else was in the room. Unfortunately, words like gaslighting were not part of my vocabulary at that particular time, so I didn't know what it was. I knew he was lying, but until I discovered what he was doing, I didn't know it was pathological. And I kept putting it down to one form of personality disorder or another, that he had no ability to have a relationship whatsoever, no love, no empathy, compassion. It soon became apparent that he would have allowed his own children to take the blame for his behavior if it meant saving his own neck and not being accountable. There was the absence of physical abuse made it very hard to nail down, especially when someone is working hard to turn the circumstance around. So I finally took the behavior I was experiencing to a psychiatrist, and I sort of laid it all out before him, and he said I have not met him or had a chance to diagnose him, but there is a name for the behavior you're describing. And he said, based solely on what you've told me, the behavior you're describing is common to covert psychopaths. I told him I don't have knowledge or skills to know how to deal with this, and he told me you don't deal with it, you run. So I also did the same with the psychologist, and he also said that based on the description I was giving him, the behavior was in keeping with either covert narcissism or covert psychopath, and he also told me I didn't deal with it, I should run. So it was explained to me that they develop a false self in childhood, and that is the person they present to everybody else. They can usually fool 100% of the people 100% of the time. They can pass polygraphs. They can fool psychiatrists. The other self is usually blatantly evil. So it's believed not curable because there's nothing in between to work with. So unlike multiple personality disorder, they're fully aware of what they're doing. They enjoy the game, and they thrive on the deception. Many psychologists won't deal with them because they get caught up in their lies and deception. There is, in my view, a high level of immaturity and cowardice about it. It's not uncommon for them to be stuck in the teen years somewhere. It certainly wasn't uncommon for my ex-husband to be stuck there somewhere. Hated exposure above all else. In a phone conversation with him after the separation, he said, "Well, now you know what I'm really like." I wondered how anyone could be proud of such a thing. Everyone to him was a tool to be used for his own purposes, and if you're not useful in some way, you were non-existent. He didn't discriminate. He played the same game with everybody. So they say when you exit a relationship with a narcissist or a psychopath, I do it quietly. Unfortunately, I didn't know that, and I was confronting him with everything I was finding out. I was later to discover that they pretty much all cheat, and they'll rape you financially, not because they need the money, but because they can't stand your success. And people like that are extremely hard to define because it's usually out of the line of vision of most people. As I looked back, I was able to put some things together, and I think the level of cruelty was a bit astounding. They also have a penchant for choosing those that make really good covers and they can hide behind. They're highly parasitical, and they don't seem to understand that the only person they really humiliate with their games is themselves. They don't have the ability to comprehend that. So that sort of was my experience. Again, if you were looking in from the outside in, that's not what you would see at all.
Getting back here to the gang stalking events that began to occur and you started to take note of, you've described what had happened to your computer. Let's talk about the phone in your home.
Well, I was having a conversation after I had my husband had left the house. I was having a conversation with my sister, and it was just a nonsensical conversation, and we were talking about my mother's maiden name and that my father had told me that in her younger years they used to call her Ducky. That was a nickname for her. And about 5 minutes after I hung up the phone, the telephone rang and a man's voice said, "Yeah, is Ducky there?" So I just said, "I'm sorry, you've got the wrong number." And so they were pretty blatant about letting me know that they were listening to my phone conversation. That was the first time I realized that they could hear everything in the house when one day I had picked up the phone at about 3 in the afternoon to make a long-distance call, and I hadn't connected that that was the time my ex-husband got off work on that particular day. And I guess he must have been trying to connect into my phone, because when I made the call, suddenly I found myself listening to my husband and his radio in his car driving home. And that's when I started to realize that. So what I did was, again, I didn't know how easy this is or how can this be done. So I do what this generation does, and I Googled it. And a company came up that actually, it's very easy, actually, and a company came up that, works with all this kind of equipment. And so I called them. They were in the United States, and I called them. And he told me how I could find out if the phone had actually been turned into a microphone. And so I did what he instructed me to do, and sure as heck, I could walk to the other side of the house and cough, and you could hear everything through the phone.
That's very disturbing. Did you find out who might have set all of that up on your telephone? Did you speak with the phone company at all?
You know, I did have someone out, but the way that they explained it to me is they don't have to actually put something on your phone. This can all be done. It can be done from a truck. It can be done in a neighborhood. It can be done through airwaves. And so they don't actually have to put something on your phone at all. There is equipment that can be bought. They simply have to plug in somebody's telephone number, and they've got it. They can hear everything that you say. It's not as difficult as it's a little bit harder to track with the technology, and it's not as hard as you would think, I discovered. And my ex-husband was also, as I was advised to talk about what I was finding, He would call me up after I had phone conversations and respond to them. Didn't make a secret of what they were doing.
At this point, you had already gone through severe trauma with the death of one of your sons, and then all of this comes at you. I can't imagine at this point what you were dealing with, but I have to say you have to be a really, really strong person, as you've shown, to keep it together. There was someone across the street from your property. Could you share that situation with listeners, please?
Yeah, it was across the front of my property. I lived on an acreage in the country. You couldn't even see my house from the road. And across the front of my property, there was a subdivision. You could actually look out my kitchen window and see the subdivision. The house directly in front, the people that owned it were away 10 months of the year. There were people supposed to be keeping an eye on it, so the house was actually vacant. And one night, it was dark, and I happened to look out, and there was somebody leaning against the tree, a man leaning against the tree, in that yard, staring at my house. I guess he didn't realize there was a street light not that far behind him. And when he realized I could see him, he, he took off. And I threw my coat on, drove around to that cul-de-sac to find whoever was looking after the house and let them know that somebody had been there. They left after that. But the interesting thing about that house is that my ex-husband's car was actually tracked there on the tracker as well to that house.
Your husband's activity that was revealed through the tracker, were you able to connect some dots and find out who he was involved with and what exactly it was?
Yeah, I was able to connect a lot of the dots because what downloaded on the computer was a lot of real estate aside from pornography. There was I couldn't really understand why I was seeing all these houses and property for sale. The tracker also tracked him, you know, to houses for sale and property. There was a lot of them. When I went to put my house up for sale, the real estate agent had handed me some paperwork that had fraud written on it. And so I asked him, what am I signing? And he said, well, this is, you know, you have to sign this for fraud because he said organized crime, Hells Angels, and so on, purchase a lot of real estate for the purposes of money laundering. And he said, that's what this form is about. And I said, well, how do they do that? How do they, you know, get away with that? And he said, well, they usually have someone with a decent credit rating. He called it a peon. And he said they will often give them the house or give them money for, you know, sort of acting as the front man for the purchase of the house or property. Then there were pictures on that had also downloaded on the computer that looked like drug delivery. There was a big there were several pictures of, you know, piles of drugs, but in one, it almost looked like some big clay container that had been cracked open, and inside there was bags of white, looked like some sort of shipment. I also had some incidences with my own garage and something being stored in a bucket of birdseed. I can only, you know, hazard a guess as to what that was. And in his car, of course, you know, there was a lot of, and in the garage, there was a lot of surgical gloves found, spoons, lighters he didn't smoke. You know, so there was, you know, there was a fair bit pointing to that he was into things a lot deeper than I could have ever imagined.
Among the gang stalking events was that you were being followed when you would go out to get groceries or run errands. Can you tell listeners more about that?
Yeah, it was always a white truck or a black truck, and I felt it was fairly obvious, and it didn't seem to matter where I went. There it was, or what long distance I happened to be traveling at the time. It was fairly evident that somebody was there, and so I used to drive aimlessly around back roads and One time I drove up to a friend's house, and the driveway almost went up the side of a hill. There was only room enough for one vehicle, and you couldn't quite see the top. So I knew they couldn't follow me up there, and so I just sat up there and had a... He wasn't home, so I sat up there and had a little snooze. And I knew it probably drove them crazy, but I was just... So I would just kind of, you know, lead them on these wild goose chases and... You know, you take your victories where you can because it's so irritating. So, yeah, I was followed pretty much everywhere. It didn't matter. They seemed to know where I was at all time. I met one of the private investigators at the cemetery on the year of my son's death, the year date, and she was meeting me, so it was quite a distance to go. Unfortunately, I had to use my cell phone to speak with her. I hadn't wanted to, but I was left with no choice. As we were there, someone pulled up again in a truck, and a man gets out, and he's walking towards us from the roadway, towards us across the grass, and he doesn't take his eyes off us the whole time. And she looked at me and said, "Oh, a friend of yours?" And I said, "No, and this is a new area. There aren't any burials there where he's walking." So I said, "It's a little obvious." So it didn't really matter where I went. They were worried about what I'd found and what I was going to do with it.
I remember you mentioning that somebody did walk up to you and actually warn you about your husband at some point. Would you share that scene with listeners, please?
Yeah, that was actually quite frightening initially because with so much happening, here I was, you know, a woman who's, you know, obviously I'm going through a tough time and I'm out in the country alone with two little kids. And I had gone into town and was beside my vehicle, and a fairly large man covered in tattoos, like a baseball cap, but a ponytail coming out of the back of the baseball cap, started to come towards me, and all I could think is, "Oh my gosh, I'm dead." So as he came to where he was striding, he looked like he had a purpose, and he stopped in front of me and he said, "Honey, your husband is a parasite, and he likes them young, very young," and he walks away. And I start to cry. But the bottom line was is that my first thought was, what is there, you know, there's honor among thieves? I don't know who he was, so that's probably an unfair statement. But whoever he was, he knew who my husband was, and he knew what he was up to. So, yeah, he did have something to say.
That's very disturbing because it implies pedophilia, especially the industry that he was involved with. I don't know if you have any kind of evidence about that in particular, but one of the locations of the tracker showed that it was a local business. And could you tell listeners about that, please?
Sure. I was driving home and recognized as I was driving by, I thought, I'm just going to pull in there because that's where the tracker had him parked. Well, when I pulled in, the building was vacant. It was all windows. Like, I could see into the inside, but it was completely vacant. But it was up for sale, and there was a telephone number. But the interesting thing about it was that inside, I took pictures of it, which I still have them. I mean, inside, there were walls with awful colors, you know, a bright red, and then there would be another wall with bright yellow, another wall. And overhead track lighting all over the ceiling. Well, those were the same colors I'd seen in some of the porn in the backdrop. So I took pictures from the outside through the window, and then I took down the telephone number, and I went home and I called. And I called this woman who was selling this property, and I just pretended I was an interested buyer. And she was quite willing to talk and said, you know, they were there for, I think she said, about a year and a half. And she said they just pulled up stakes suddenly. Well, they pulled up stakes suddenly. I asked her when, and that was exactly the time he found out I had been tracking him. So they pulled up stakes, and I said, oh. So I said the business went under. She said, no. He said he was going to open it up somewhere closer to town. So he said, she said they didn't even, they bought their way out of the lease or whatever it was and pulled up stakes. She said it was the oddest thing she'd ever seen. She said they practically pulled up stakes overnight. And I said, oh, and she did. Then she went on to say, you know, what repairs the building needed and so on. So I said, well, when he said he was moving closer to town, what town was he referring to? And she told me. And I said, okay, well, you know, I appreciated what she told me. So a couple of days later, there had been a similar business open up close to one of the towns where I lived. And I went in there and just took a stroll around. Well, in one of the porn pictures that had come up, there was an old cloth bathtub. But that cloth bathtub was yellow. Like, I mean, it was a very god-awful bright yellow. And as I was walking around this this building, there was an old white cloth bathtub, so I didn't think too much of it. But as I walked past it, I glanced backwards, and one side of it had been painted yellow. My ex-husband had come home to I don't know whether he was picking something up or dropping something off. I can't remember. But he'd left the trunk of his car open within a couple of days, and there was two full cans of unopened paint in his trunk of his car, same colors. So I just thought, okay, well, there was a lot of that kind of thing went on, but then I was looking hard for answers, and I was pursuing all of those things. So
while you're doing this level of investigation, there were some intimidation tactics used. For example, someone walking into your home. Can you tell listeners about that?
Mm-hmm. I was in the kitchen, actually, with my daughters, and I was actually sitting at the counter. And when you're sitting at the counter, you can see directly. It was a split level, so you could see directly into the front entranceway, which the hallway went through and led to the downstairs rumpus room, and I could see also directly up into the living room. My daughters were facing me, and I was actually facing that area when a man just actually walked right in into the front entranceway area, stuck his head sort of around the corner at us, smiled, because he thought this was funny, obviously, and walked out again. And my daughter kind of went, oh, my God, who was that? And to this day, I have no idea how they were getting in. I don't know how he got in. He, you know, the back door, my bedroom window, very possibly that was almost ground level. That would have been easy enough for him to do. But, yeah, he walked right in. My children were watching TV one night in the rumpus room and came flying upstairs, upset. Somebody's outside knocking on the window while they're downstairs watching TV. My sliding door that went out on the sun deck, I came home one day and the lock had been ripped out, and the entire door had been ripped right out of the tracking. And I actually, for a while, was using a stick, you know, to keep it shut so that nobody could to get in. There were stuff stolen. They came and went as they darn well pleased. I even had tried to have the locks changed at one point, and that was not effective either. So there was things constantly going missing and stolen. I had a whole list of things that were missing. I came home one day. I think I must have very nearly caught someone, because in my office, my desk is very large and very heavy. One doesn't just move it easily. The desk was pulled out from the wall, and a screwdriver was left on my desk. So I never knew if they put something in or they took something out or what they did. But, there was a fair bit of intimidation practices. I came home, the house was up for sale, and so, you know, you're much more careful about making sure that you keep it vacuumed and everything looking great. So I had vacuumed before I dropped my daughters off at school and came home, and on the carpeting at the base of my bed was the hugest footprint I have ever seen in the carpeting. I have pictures of that as well. In fact, I have pictures of most things. I was taking them with my phone regularly. And at this point, my ex-husband was staying up at our fifth wheel temporarily. And every once in a while, I would go up there. I would find American money. I don't know what he was doing with that. I did take pictures of it. I would find scratched notes $5,000 to so-and-so, this amount to so-and-so. I took pictures of all of that. The bedroom area, he had put a piece of plastic and stapled it all shut all around that bedroom area. The mattress itself on the bed had been rolled over, and when I pulled some of the plastic off, inside the fold of the mattress was a bunch of the seed from the bucket in the garage. So there was lots of that kind of thing happening. Being on an acreage at night, I didn't know who was around and who was creeping around the property, or if they would, obviously they could have gotten in, I guess, if they wanted to, but they didn't physically hurt myself or the girls, but certainly they scared us often enough.
You saw some of your objects that went missing in some of the footage of the pornography footage.
Yes. Yeah, that was quite an experience. I had my youngest two daughters are adopted from out of the country. They were kind of like a second family for me. They had arrived with some very unusual diapers. They had extra padding in the center of the diaper. I hadn't seen them in Canada before. After they were all potty trained, I threw these in a rag bin. And they just, all these diapers, when I went to get them as rags, they were just gone. And there was a picture of a woman in the back of a car with no clothes on, obviously, and she was sitting on one of these padded diaper things. And then another time, I had redecorated my home probably a couple of years prior to all of this. And when I had done my girl's bedroom, I had, in a small community, I had ordered most of the things for them from the United States. So in a small community, it's not likely there were two bedrooms the same. One of the blankets that I had ordered for their beds were way too large, and I had wound up cutting them and sewing them. And then I kept these wide, strips of blanket for whatever reason I did. And there in the porn was these wide strips of blanket. But of particular note was I had ordered some very unusual toss pillows, and I had had a basket full of toss pillows that I had brought home from the fifth wheel because I was going to mend them. This whole thing went missing, and I kept saying, where did my pillows go that I was going to mend? Where did they go? At one point, I saw them in the garage, and I had said to my husband at the time, how did those get in here? And he said, oh, they were taking up too much space in the storage in the house. And so he said, I brought them to the garage. Then they went missing altogether. But the two toss pillows I had bought for them were very unusual and very brightly striped. I still have one sitting on my bed to this day. One of them went missing. And those pillows showed up in the porn, including the very bright striped one that I have the matching one to. My things were showing up in there. A flannel sheet that had gone missing was used as a backdrop. Quite a number of things actually showed up in there.
Right. You should get credited for set design.
Yeah, or something.
Yeah. It's not even proper.
It's okay. It's been a while. I don't. My feelings don't get hurt about this kind of thing too much anymore.
Michaela, the photos that you took, you used your cell phone to do that. Not unlike what happened to Susan Conley, a past guest, discussing very similar events. Can you tell listeners what happened there?
My phone went missing. I'd been in town with my daughters one evening. It went missing. We had gone in for something to eat, and it went missing right out of my vehicle. I was extremely upset because I had pictures of my son. We're on that phone. I had called my ex-husband and said, my phone is gone, and I said, there are pictures of my son on that phone. Within a day or so, I found my phone on the lawn. We had looked. It was right beside the driveway. We had searched everywhere. You couldn't have missed it. And it was thrown there, but it was open, and the camera was broken. But the pictures were still there, so that was the main thing. So my phone had been I tampered with than my cell phone.
And what's interesting about that is with Susan Conley, she discovered that it was possible to clone cell phones, meaning you can make an exact copy of your particular phone, and when your phone rings, the clone copy rings, and you just get all the data of that phone. So,
hadn't heard that, but that wouldn't surprise me in the slightest bit. All of this stuff was new to me. I had no idea, so I was getting quite an education.
As mentioned earlier, the stealing of the cell phone happened to Susan Conley. In our second interview, we went into a little more depth. Let's hear a clip from that interview as it relates to this interview with Michaela.
Yeah, it was probably about 14 months ago. I lived in an apartment before the house I live in Virginia right now, that I had my iPhone stolen actually three times. The first time I woke up, I had fallen asleep. It was always on my bed or a nightstand or whatever, charging. And it was literally just gone. It had just disappeared. So I purchased another one and probably had that for a few months. And that one disappeared. I should say stolen, the same type of circumstances. That one actually, though, suddenly appeared on my kitchen counter, you know, after it had been stolen for a few weeks. And I could never make sense of anything because sometimes, you know, things would be stolen and then they were returned the next morning or within a few weeks. And I was always so physically sick from microwave attacks or poisoning or whatever that, you know, I was always behind the eight ball, so to speak, so much. And it was so hard for me to be proactive and try and figure out what in the heck was going on. But probably almost a year ago, I was looking for like an old contact number, and I was going through past cell phone records, and I kept noticing that almost every month, like clockwork, there was a call made to my ex's cell phone number for usually just 1 minute, sometimes, you know, longer, or sometimes a couple times a month. And I remember thinking that is very odd because I haven't spoken to him in probably 4 years. Yet there were these calls to him. So I started doing research, you know, putting all the pieces together. Well, my phone has been stolen and there are calls to him, and actually calls to other numbers, because I did a lot of research that I don't even recognize, but I don't have the wherewithal to pursue all that. But I started doing research online, and, you know, in being in the telecommunications business for 15 years, I knew it was possible that a physical phone can be cloned, so to speak, if that phone is stolen and, you know, they have sort of an identical phone. And, you know, it gets very technical beyond that, you know, I don't understand all that. And the ability to do that is very, very professional. It would require a lot of expertise, you know, based on the research I wrote, but it can be done. So I believe that all of my, you know, texts, email, phone calls, you know, are constantly monitored, heard, because there's an identical phone out there, you know, duplicating everything that I'm doing. And especially if these people don't want to be traced, it makes sense that they're going to call, you know, the person in charge, so to speak, my ex, and give updates or whatever, and there's no trace of communication. I mean, obviously I can't prove that I didn't make those calls. That's not proof in and of itself. However, I know I didn't because I haven't spoken to him in 4 years.
Yeah, I'm trying to understand the motivation or how it would help a organized covert stalking group to clone a target's phone. Why would they want to do that? How would it help? What are your thoughts on that?
I believe that's the most ingenious way to spy or monitor, you know, a target. They're always going to be one step ahead of the target. Say, oh, I plan on meeting this person for lunch. They already know I'm going to be gone at this certain time. It kind of alleviates the so-called need in a way for maybe cameras or, you know, the surveillance equipment. You know, if they have your communication device duplicated, so to speak, they're going to be aware of your every move, your conversation, your thoughts and feelings. And it seems to me that's the ultimate way to, you know, spy and stalk on someone.
Were you conscious of that level of surveillance, and would you avoid using that phone in certain cases where you knew that, well, if I say anything here and go to this location, they're going to know, so I won't use it?
You know, I actually did for a while. I purchased a burner phone right before I relocated about 6 months ago from Arizona to Virginia, where I live now, because I didn't want them, in quotes, to know I was moving and the address and all that. And I thought, you know, I had gotten away free, so to speak, but I was not successful, even when I used that burner phone. And I don't know, you know, how or why or what equipment they might have used to actually track me. It could have been maybe I did an internet search on the address, you know, that I live at now, or maybe there was surveillance equipment in the apartment that I lived in, and they heard my conversations through a recording device or whatever. I'm just guessing. I still use this phone now, and I know it's being monitored, but I really don't have anything to hide at this point. I'm, you know, here for a while. Beyond that, I'm not really sure. My stalking was just, you know, to that level, like monitoring every conversation or email or text and stealing or moving items and things like that, trying to make me look crazy or, you know, make the actual person think they were going crazy. That would be, let's see, manageable, I believe. But now with the electronic harassment, it, you know, those things are very minor to me. Now I am physically assaulted pretty much 24/7, and it's extremely difficult to live, you know, day by day and just get even the most minor of tasks done. It's a life, but it's not a life. You're merely existing or surviving. You know, you're not thriving or looking forward to future events. You're just in survival mode.
That was a past interview with Susan Conley, who is a victim of organized stalking in Virginia and continues to go through a lot of trauma to this day. Michaela, has the stalking ended for the most part?
For the most part, I would have to say it has. Now, they do does rear its ugly head every now and again and puts me through a bit of a bad time. But for the most part, you know, I don't suffer a lot from it. Like, there were many things that I... It's psychological warfare, and I guess I'm believing if they can't affect me psychologically, they can't really, you know, there's not much they can do. And so I don't allow that to happen. I don't allow it to affect me. So generally it's quite short-lived when it does happen, and, you know, you just push forward. That's the way it is.
Michaela, you had an interesting childhood that may have connections to the organized stalking tactics you've experienced. Would you please tell listeners what you've learned about parts of your childhood?
I have had stalking before. I just didn't know it was stalking. 2 years after I married, I purchased a home about 50 miles from where I lived. And 2 days after I moved, my sister, who had lived next door to me, received a call in the middle of the night with a man who was loudly demanding, "Where is she?" And my sister asked who, and he said, "Your sister, where is she?" And she threatened to hang up, and he said, "Don't you dare hang up on me. Where is she?" She threatened to call the police, and she finally did hang up on him. You know, there have been various calls throughout the years, intermittently, vehicle parked right across the street from me for some time, and when he realized, I think that I was wondering what he was doing there, he sort of moved on. So there were intermittent things like that throughout throughout my adult life. I just didn't realize that that's what they were. And I spent a period of time as I was growing up in Subarctic, and it was the only military base that had the rocketry program. And it was an American, it was the Cold War American Canadian military bases, the NORAD bases. Well, I actually, there's something called Project Second Story, and it's interesting because it goes back to someone who is studying consciousness and reality and flying saucers and whatever, but the last statement under Second Story was that we have substantiated reports that this research and other related highly classified study and development was moved to a MOD base in the far north away from eyes and ears of the media. Well, there's several like that, and I know in the United States that program was usually affiliated with their secret space program. Because they were studying psychic abilities with children, it was called a theta program. Well, being a kid who had inherited some of those, being in the Cold War, being in the only military base in Canada that had that program, and having a long-standing Freemason background, which other children from other parts of Canada, not in the space program, but other children had the same. They all had Freemasonry in their background. You know, you kind of had to start asking myself, well, gee, did they miss me? That's highly unlikely. And so during those Cold War years, I did start retrieving some memories back from that time, and I have really been researching what's been going on there for about 8 years now. So that's, you know, kind of in a nutshell, but I think everybody's perfectly aware that some very, very strange things were done in the Cold War, and particularly around that space program that they think is a big secret that isn't. There's that, and it's probably all tied in.
Michaela, would you talk about how becoming a trauma counselor may have helped you manage and get through some of the additional stress related to the organized stalking?
That's a really good question. The trauma helped me to get through the trauma surrounding my son's death. I'm sure that anything else, that there are many reasons for trauma, but the symptoms are always the same. And so I'm sure that that had the trauma of everything. It was very traumatizing to go through what I went through and to find out the things that I discovered. So there was trauma on trauma at that particular point in my life. So I think the trauma studies were really a lifeline in a lot of ways. And helped me to walk through, but it wasn't a short walk by any stretch. It was a long walk through the other side, because there had been a significant amount of trauma in a short space of time and a lot of losses. So,
Michaela, I understand there's also a book being written about your experience. Would you please tell listeners about that?
Well, it's in the works, my son had left a note on his BlackBerry before he died, and it said, "I'm so sorry, Mom, I just can't live in a world without truth." And so the book is called World Without Truth, and it is the goal that my son will have it one way or the other. Hopefully the book will help others as well. That's about all I can tell you about it at this point in time, because it's still very much in rough form. I would like to add, in addition, for anyone who's listening, that I did wake up in the middle of the night a few years ago, and I felt as if a veil had lifted. I went from viewing what had happened in my life, and suddenly I was looking outward at the world, and it was a replica. So what's happening in the world was just exactly like what had happened in my own home in terms of, you know, the sort of deception that we are regularly handed, and that motives behind that are not what's being presented. And I realized that this is the same. So I think it is a difficult time for people to live in. Trauma is, working with trauma is the only way I know how to fight. But I wanted to make sure I said that because I think the deception that we are under, there's a lot of spin doctoring going on and so on within our culture and all the systems attached to it. And very seldom are the motives behind what we're being handed the same. Everyone is experiencing it, and we have never, ever been surveilled in the way that we are now. So I think everybody, to some degree, is experiencing what I experienced on a larger scale. Yeah, I think people are feeling off, you know, by it all.
Well, Michaela, there are parallels in your organized stalking case that line up with events of past guests, but thankfully there are some really dreadful things missing too. And I appreciate you describing for listeners what it's like confronting the psychopath in your life. It's a sobering reality indeed. I suspect the actions you've taken to investigate on your own, defend yourself, and learn how to professionally manage trauma will be an inspiration to some listeners. Thank you again for being on In Other News.
My pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, that's going to do it for In Other News. I'm Jeff Brady. Visit inothernewsradio.com for archives and more information about the guests.
So you're free. So happy birthday.